شيل شيل عجم مالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو.
You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College. Today is Sunday, May 10th, 2026. Before we step into this hour, a brief reminder for our listeners. The reflections you hear tonight belong solely to our hosts and guests. They do not necessarily represent the views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. This Week in Palestine is where truth strides in with purpose and strength. It stands unyielding, never diluted or reshaped to appease the powerful. Here, truth commands the room with its undeniable presence. Urgency beats like a living pulse, driving us forward. Clarity is embraced as a duty, essential and unwavering. While we focus on Palestine, the West Bank, and Gaza, we also shine a light on global stories that, though they may seem distant, resonate deeply and influence the lives of Palestinians and the future of Palestine in profound and impactful ways. Wherever you find yourself, driving through the long stretch of night, lifting your first cup of coffee into the morning light, or sitting quietly in the stillness of your home, thank you for being part of our journey. I am your host and narrator, Arlene Russell. On this program, we embrace the full spectrum of reality. We tell the story as it is, with courage and authenticity. Here, we celebrate honesty and the strength it brings to our lives. This is a space where truth shines brightly, unfiltered and unwavering. Here, resistance is a lived reality, a testament to the power of action and conviction. Solidarity is not just a word, but a cherished legacy, passed down through generations as a beacon of strength. In this space, the voices rising from occupied lands are powerful and united, undeterred by attempts to silence them. They ascend in harmony, standing alongside global movements that demand dignity, justice, and liberation for all people. This hour transcends a mere broadcast. It is a lifeline. It is a thread that stretches from Palestine to every corner of the globe, weaving together shattered homes with unyielding hope, transforming devastation into determination, and channeling grief into a future full of promise and possibility. In the deepest darkness, the ember of defiance shines brightly, unwavering and bold. Each week, we deliver reporting that pierces through distortion, offering analysis that reveals truth and reflections that celebrate the rich tapestry of Palestinian life, its depth, struggle, beauty, and humanity. We speak with purpose, for the stakes demand nothing less than our full commitment. This Week in Palestine stands as a beacon of testimony, urgency, and unyielding solidarity. The struggle for liberation transcends borders, uniting us all in a shared, global, and sacred mission. Before we begin today's episode, before we dive into the stories, the analysis, the weight of the world, I want to take a moment to honor someone who often carries more than any headline ever will. Today is Mother's Day. And to every mother listening, every mother working late, waking early, holding families together with strength the world rarely sees, every mother who has loved without rest, sacrificed without applause, and endured without recognition, this moment is for you. To the mothers in our homes, the mothers across oceans, the mothers in refugee camps, the mothers rebuilding their lives, the mothers who are here, and the mothers we carry in memory, we see you. You are the quiet architecture of our lives. You are the first voice we hear, the first hand that steadies us, the first love that teaches us what love even means.
and to everyone else. Fathers, husbands, sons, daughters, friends, coworkers. Somewhere in your life, there is a mother who shaped you. Reach out to her today. Call her. Visit her. Bring her flowers, a card, a cup of coffee. Tell her she matters. Tell her you're grateful. Tell her you remember. Not because it's expected, not because it's on the calendar, but because she deserves to hear it. So before we begin, from my heart to yours, happy Mother's Day to all the beautiful, strong, resilient mothers out there. This episode is dedicated to you.
I was not sure how I wanted to begin today's episode. Some days, the weight of everything happening in the world sits so heavily on the mind that even choosing the first sentence feels impossible. My thoughts are scattered across continents, across headlines, across the lives of people who are carrying more than any human being should ever be asked to carry. My heart is with Palestine, with the families in Gaza and the West Bank who wake up each morning not knowing what the next hour will bring. I think about the parents trying to shield their children from a world that refuses to shield them. I think about the homes reduced to rubble, the neighborhoods erased, the generations uprooted. And I think about the grief that never gets a chance to rest.
My thoughts drift to Iran as well, to the reports of lives lost in the first wave of strikes, including young girls whose futures were stolen before they even had a chance to begin. I think about how quickly numbers appear on screens, how easily they are repeated, and how rarely we stop to imagine the human beings behind those numbers, their names, their dreams, their families waiting for them to come home. And then my mind goes further back, to the long shadow of American foreign policy, to Iraq, to Afghanistan, to Libya, to Sudan, to the places where decisions made in distant rooms reshaped entire nations, leaving behind scars that still have not healed. I think about the promises made, the promises broken, and the people who paid the price for choices they never had a voice in. But my thoughts do not stop at borders. They come home, right here, to the country we live in, to the administration in power, to the systems that shape our daily lives, to the corruption people talk about, the influence of money, the decisions that seem to benefit the wealthy while ordinary families struggle to breathe.
I think about the single mother working 70 or 80 hours a week just to keep a roof over her children's heads. I think about the father juggling two jobs and still falling behind on rent. I think about the young people drowning in debt before they even start their adult lives. And I think about the widening gap between those who have more than they could ever spend and those who are one unexpected bill away from losing everything. All of these thoughts, Palestine, Iran, the echoes of past wars, the weight of present struggles, they collide in my mind. They overlap. They blur. Because none of these stories exist in isolation. They are connected by power, by policy, by the choices of leaders, by the consequences that fall on ordinary people. And so today, I begin with honesty, with the truth that my thoughts are scattered, heavy, and restless, with the truth that the world feels like it is unraveling in too many places at once, with the truth that behind every headline is a human life, a family, a story that deserves to be seen.
What if just once the United States chose a different path? What if instead of reaching for war as the first answer, we reached for wisdom, restraint, and imagination? What if we allowed ourselves to believe that strength is not measured by the number of conflicts we enter, but by the number of conflicts we refuse to ignite? Imagine a country that decides finally, that war is not the engine of its future. A country that steps back from the endless cycle of intervention and asks, what if we stopped inserting ourselves into every global dispute? What if we stopped shaping other nations' destinies
while neglecting our own? What if we lived up to the image we project on paper, the image of a civil, principled, forward-thinking nation, instead of contradicting it with our actions?
Picture the United States taking all the money poured into conflict, into weapons, into bases, into destruction, and investing it instead in our youth, in education, in healthcare, in rebuilding our cities, in strengthening our communities, in preparing a future worthy of the next generation. Where would we be today if even a fraction of that investment had been made? How many lives would be different? How many dreams would be possible? How many families would be lifted, healed, supported, empowered? Imagine a country that opens itself to the world not through force, but through example. A nation that earns respect not by the size of its military, but by the depth of its humanity. A nation that becomes once again the dreamland it was once described as, not because of slogans, but because of lived reality. And imagine a media landscape that tells the truth without bending it to serve political interests.
A media that does not distract, distort, or divide. A media that does not bury suffering under spectacle. A media that does not decide which lives matter based on alliances or agendas. What if we had the courage to build relationships instead of enemies? What if we invested in diplomacy instead of destruction? What if we stood tall on our own principles instead of kneeling to the demands of any foreign government, any lobby, any pressure that pushes us into wars that do not serve the American people? What if, for the first time in a long time, we chose peace, not as a slogan, but as a strategy? Tonight, we begin with these questions, not because they are easy, but because they are necessary. Not because they offer simple answers, but because they open the door to a different kind of future, one we rarely allow ourselves to imagine. This is This Week in Palestine, and this hour is an invitation to think boldly, question deeply, and imagine a world where justice, truth, and humanity guide our choices, not fear, not pressure, not profit, and not war. This is This Week in Palestine.
Now, okay, let me tell you something you will almost never hear on mainstream news or across the big social media platforms. A story that sits at the center of the negotiations over Gaza, yet somehow remains outside the headlines. A story that reveals just how far apart the sides really are. According to reporting from Middle East Eye, Israel and the United States have been demanding the full disarmament of Hamas as a condition for any political or humanitarian progress in Gaza. But Palestinian factions, including Hamas, have argued that disarming now, before any political resolution, would leave Gaza completely vulnerable. Their position is that if they were to hand over their weapons today, Israel could move in and take control of the rest of the territory, leaving Palestinians with no protection and no leverage. They say that disarmament cannot come first. Instead, they insist that a sovereign Palestinian state must be established and that only then would weapons be transferred to a unified Palestinian government.
Now, okay. Let me tell you something you will almost never hear on mainstream news or across the big social media platforms. A story that sits at the center of the negotiations over Gaza, yet somehow remains outside the headlines. A story that reveals just how far apart the sides really are. According to reporting from Middle East Eye, Israel and the United States have been demanding the full disarmament of Hamas as a condition for any political or humanitarian progress in Gaza. But Palestinian factions, including Hamas, have argued that disarming now, before any political resolution, would leave Gaza completely vulnerable. Their position is simple. If they were to hand over their weapons today, Israel could move in and take control of the rest of the territory, leaving Palestinians with no protection and no leverage.
They say disarmament cannot come first. Instead, they insist that a sovereign Palestinian state must be established, and that only then would weapons be transferred to a unified Palestinian government.
And look, here is where the story becomes even more complex. Middle East Eye reports that a joint Palestinian proposal, drafted by multiple factions, not just Hamas, was submitted during recent negotiations in Cairo and Istanbul. This proposal linked disarmament to political rights, to security guarantees, and to the basic condition that Palestinians in Gaza would no longer be killed. It was an attempt to tie security to sovereignty, to make disarmament part of a larger political settlement rather than a precondition. But according to the reporting, the United States and Israel rejected that proposal. Not only rejected it, mediators reportedly delivered sharp messages back to the Palestinian negotiating team, making it clear that Washington and Tel Aviv would not accept any plan that delays disarmament until after statehood.
Okay. We know this is the heart of the disagreement. On one side, the U.S. and Israel insist that weapons must be surrendered first, before any technocratic government is formed in Gaza. On the other side, Palestinian factions argue that disarmament without political rights is impossible, that it would leave Gaza exposed, unprotected, and without any guarantee of safety or sovereignty. The Palestinian proposal, as reviewed by Middle East Eye, called for a sequence: a ceasefire, humanitarian access, withdrawal of Israeli forces to agreed lines, reconstruction, international oversight, and then, only then, a process to address weapons within a national political framework. They tied disarmament to the establishment of a Palestinian state, to security guarantees for both sides, and to the right of Palestinians to self-determination.
But the talks hit a wall. I mean, what are you expecting from a negotiation team that's on the phone with Netanyahu following his instructions? Mediators from Egypt and Turkey received the Palestinian document, but according to the report, both the Americans and the mediators rejected it the next day. The U.S. and Israel maintain that disarmament must come first. Palestinian factions maintain that political rights must come first. And so, the negotiations stalled once again. Meanwhile, the situation on the ground continues to shift. Middle East Eye cites UN figures reporting hundreds of Palestinians killed in the months following the ceasefire agreement. Humanitarian aid deliveries have fallen far short of the levels outlined in the October deal. And reports indicate that Israeli forces have expanded their presence beyond the boundaries originally agreed upon, moving past what was called the Yellow Line into deeper parts of Gaza. All of this is happening while discussions continue about what Gaza's future governance should look like, who should lead it, and what role international forces might play. But the core issue remains unresolved. Should disarmament come before political rights, or should political rights come before disarmament? That is the story. A story rarely told, rarely explained, and rarely given the space it deserves. A story about negotiations, power, fear, sovereignty, and the future of an entire people. And with Middle East Eye, it is unfolding right now.
Now, listen to this. Before the negotiators walked out, before the mediators delivered their warnings, before the world turned the page to the next headline, there was a moment, a single moment, when Gaza's future hung on a document almost no one will ever see. A proposal written in secret rooms, carried between Cairo and Istanbul, signed by factions who rarely agree on anything. A proposal that tied disarmament to statehood, security to sovereignty, and survival to the simple promise that people would no longer be killed. It lasted less than 24 hours. Rejected, dismissed, buried. And yet, inside that rejected paper lies the story of everything that is happening now. The war, the negotiations, the pressure, the fear, and the question no one wants to answer. How do you ask a people to lay down their weapons when they do not yet have a state to protect them? Before the papers were rejected, before the delegations walked out, before the world looked away again, a single question hung in the air.
how do you ask a people to disarm when they do not yet have a state to protect them? In Gaza, a father digs through rubble with his bare hands. In Cairo, negotiators argue over the meaning of the word security. In Washington, a document is dismissed in less than a day. Three rooms, three realities, one future hanging in the balance. The proposal lasted less than 24 hours. It was written, submitted, rejected, and buried all before most of the world even knew it existed. Now, let's start over. This is a story the world must hear. A story of courage, resilience, and unwavering truth. It's a narrative that often remains hidden, but when it emerges, it shines with clarity and strength. It reminds us that we, alongside those who seek justice, can be the heroes, the defenders of truth and peace. In a world where narratives are often manipulated, the resolve of the Palestinian people stands as a testament to their strength. They are not the aggressors in their own story, but the resilient seekers of justice and dignity. The voices of hungry children, yearning for shelter and a future, call for understanding and solidarity, not blame. Today, we bring you this story as it truly is, unfiltered and powerful. The world has its chosen narratives, but it is time to amplify those that inspire us to stand up for what is right. Today, we share a story close to the hearts of many Palestinians and some French allies. Yes, French, from a nation that may be known for its military support to Israel, but also home to individuals who rise against injustice. Our story is about one of those brave souls who chose action over silence, justice over complacency, and righteousness over wrongdoing. This is a celebration of those who refuse to stay silent, who refuse to be sidelined, and who stand for what is just and true. Let their courage inspire us all to be advocates for peace and truth.
She was not Palestinian. She was not born in a refugee camp. She did not inherit the trauma, the displacement, or the history of a people forced from their land. But she chose to stand with them. Her name was Françoise Kesteman, a French nurse who arrived in Lebanon in the late 1970s, at a time when the country was torn apart by civil war and Palestinian refugee camps were under siege. She came not as a politician, not as a soldier, but as a caregiver, someone who believed that tending to the wounded was not just a profession, but a moral obligation. Françoise worked inside the camps of Beirut and southern Lebanon, where thousands of Palestinians lived in overcrowded, impoverished conditions after being displaced from their homes decades earlier. She saw the suffering up close, the children growing up without a homeland, the families living under bombardment, the wounded arriving day after day with injuries that told the story of a conflict the world rarely looked at directly.
And something inside her shifted. She was not content to simply treat the wounds. She wanted to confront the cause of those wounds. Françoise became politically active, aligning herself with Palestinian groups who believed that resisting occupation was the only path to dignity. She was a communist, a believer in liberation movements, and she saw the Palestinian struggle as one of the great injustices of the modern world. She joined armed Palestinian factions, not out of a desire for violence, but out of a conviction that oppressed people had the right to defend themselves. Her commitment was total. She lived with the fighters. She worked in their clinics. She traveled with them between camps. She became part of their world. And then, in 1984, her life ended.
Françoise Kesteman was killed during a paramilitary operation in Lebanon, an operation tied to the broader conflict between Israeli forces, Lebanese militias, and Palestinian resistance groups. The exact details of her death remain part of the chaotic, violent landscape of that era.
But what is clear is this. She died standing with the people she had chosen to call her own. Her story is not widely known. You won't find it in most history books. You won't hear it on major news networks. But in the refugee camps of Lebanon, her name still carries weight. She is remembered as a foreigner who crossed oceans not for glory, not for politics, but for solidarity. A woman who believed that justice was not a nationality, it was a responsibility. Françoise Kesteman's life asks a question that echoes long after her death. What does it mean to stand with a people who are not your own? What does it mean to give everything, even your life, for a cause rooted in someone else's suffering? For Françoise, the answer was simple. Humanity has no borders.
Today, I want to talk to you about the idea of Israel collapsing. Or maybe I should be more precise. Why I believe Israel is collapsing. No, even that doesn't feel strong enough. Let's say it plainly. Why Israel itself knows it is collapsing. But before we go there, before we step into the heart of that argument, we need to talk about something else. The moments in history when the world shifts. Not suddenly, not explosively, but quietly, steadily, like a tide pulling away from the shore. You don't notice it at first. A statement here, a vote there, a hesitation, a pause, a silence where there used to be applause. And then one day, you look up, and the world is no longer where it used to be. Today, I want to take you into that shift. The slow, undeniable turning of global opinion. The steady erosion of political patience. The widening gap between what Israel claims about itself and what the world now sees with its own eyes. This shift did not begin with one event. It did not begin with one war. It did not begin with one leader or one decision. It began with a pattern of actions, a pattern of policies, a pattern of violence and impunity that has become impossible for the world to ignore. For decades, governments looked away. For decades, institutions softened their language. For decades, the world convinced itself that silence was diplomacy and that neutrality was wisdom. But something has changed. Something fundamental, something irreversible. And that is what I want to talk about today. Not a prediction of the future. This is my perspective, shaped by the facts, shaped by the reporting, shaped by the global reactions we are witnessing in real time, and shaped by what the world is finally willing to say out loud. The tide is shifting. The ground is moving. And Israel, for the first time in its history, is standing on soil that no longer feels solid beneath its feet. So, okay, look at this. The world is turning against Israel. Not all at once, not in a dramatic rupture, but in a slow, deliberate shift. The kind of shift that only becomes obvious when you step back and look at the horizon. There was a time when Israel's alliances looked unbreakable, a time when its political shield in the West felt permanent, unquestionable, almost sacred. But that era is fading. The crack is visible now, not a hairline fracture, but a widening line running straight through the foundation of Israel's global support. One country voices concern, another pauses an arms shipment, another abstains from a vote it once supported without hesitation. Individually, these actions seem small, almost insignificant. But when you place them side by side, a pattern emerges. A picture of a state slowly losing the diplomatic protection it once assumed was guaranteed. For decades, Israel relied on a simple assumption that Western nations would always stand behind it, no matter the circumstance, no matter the cost. But that assumption is eroding.
Germany, France, Canada, the United Kingdom, nations that once offered unwavering support, are now issuing sharp statements, public criticisms, and in some cases, direct challenges to Israeli policy. These are not symbolic gestures.
they are signals. Signals that the political climate has shifted, that patience has thinned, that the old rules no longer apply. This is not a wave. Waves crash and retreat. This is a tide, slow, steady, and relentless. And tides do not reverse themselves because someone wishes them to. They move according to deeper forces: public opinion, international law, moral pressure, and the undeniable weight of what the world has witnessed. What we're seeing now is the beginning of a realignment, a recalibration of global conscience, a recognition that silence is no longer sustainable, and that the cost of unconditional support has become too high for many nations to bear. The shift is happening. The tide is rising. And once a tide begins to turn, it does not turn back.
For decades, Western governments spoke with one voice. Israel had the right to defend itself, the right to act, the right to wage war as it saw fit. But now, that voice is fractured. In Europe, leaders who once defended Israel at every turn are now questioning its actions. In Canada, the tone has shifted from support to alarm. In the UK, the government has begun to distance itself, step by step, from policies it once endorsed without hesitation. And in the United States, Israel's most important ally, the shift is seismic. Younger Americans, including younger conservatives and evangelicals, no longer see Israel as a moral project. They see a state that has crossed lines, broken norms, and abandoned restraint. This is not a fringe movement. This is the mainstream.
The turning of the world did not happen in a vacuum. It happened because of Gaza, because of the images, the testimonies, the destruction, the mass death. It happened because the world watched entire neighborhoods flattened, hospitals bombed, journalists killed, children buried under rubble. For years, Israel relied on the argument that its wars were defensive, necessary, justified. But Gaza shattered that narrative. The scale of destruction was too large, the civilian toll too undeniable, the footage too raw, too real, too immediate. The world could no longer look away. And once you see something clearly, you cannot unsee it.
While the West hesitated, the global South did not. Countries across Africa, Asia, and Latin America condemned Israel's actions with a clarity the West had avoided for decades. They saw Gaza not as a conflict, but as a colonial war, a war they recognized from their own histories. South Africa took Israel to the International Court of Justice. Brazil, Colombia, Chile, and others issued statements that would have been unthinkable 10 years ago. The Arab world, long divided, found a rare moment of unity. The world was no longer speaking in whispers. It was speaking in declarations.
I watched a video from Max Fisher, and his video shows something remarkable. A visual map of Israel's alliances shrinking. Not because countries suddenly turned hostile, but because Israel's actions made neutrality impossible. A state cannot bomb refugee camps and expect silence. A state cannot starve a population and expect support. A state cannot wage endless war and expect endless patience. Israel's isolation is not the result of propaganda. It is the result of policy.
Governments move slowly. People move faster. Across Europe, protests filled the streets. Not fringe activists, but ordinary citizens, students, workers, parents, clergy. In the United States, polls showed a dramatic shift. For the first time, more Americans disapproved of Israel's actions than approved. This is not a temporary reaction. It is a generational shift. Young people do not see Israel through the lens of 1948 or 1967. They see it through the lens of Gaza, the West Bank, and the occupation. They see a state that has lost its moral narrative. And once a generation turns, it does not turn back.
It's simple. When public opinion shifts, political consequences follow.
European governments are debating sanctions. The United States is facing internal pressure to condition military aid. International courts are investigating war crimes. Trade agreements are being questioned. Diplomatic visits are being canceled. Israel is discovering something it never expected, that power does not guarantee immunity. For decades, Israel told the world a lie. Okay, wait, I will be nice. Israel told the world a story. We are the victims. We are the democracy. We are the moral army. But Gaza broke that story. The footage broke it. The testimonies broke it. The numbers broke it. The world is no longer willing to accept the narrative at face value. And when a state loses its story, it loses its shield. The world is not turning on Israel because of hatred. It is turning because of clarity, because the gap between Israel's narrative and Israel's actions has become too wide to ignore. This is not about delegitimization. This is not about anti-Semitism. This is about accountability. A state cannot demand unconditional support while acting without restraint. A state cannot expect loyalty while ignoring international law. A state cannot claim moral authority while committing acts the world can see in real time. The world is turning because the world is watching.
Okay, where does this lead? No one knows. Actually, we all know. Do you want me to say it out loud or should I whisper it? It's called collapsing. You heard me. Collapsing. Because one thing is unmistakably clear. The era of automatic support is over. The era of unquestioned alliances is ending. The world is no longer willing to look away, no longer willing to pretend it doesn't see what it sees. And once the world turns, truly turns, it rarely turns back. Israel is stepping into a new chapter, not because the world hates it, not because of some sudden shift in sentiment, but because the world has finally seen it, seen the reality, the consequences, the truth that can no longer be softened or explained away. And like we said a minute ago, once you see something clearly, you cannot unsee it. Not today, not tomorrow, not ever.
Now, let's delve into the phenomenon of state collapses. Countries can and do collapse, especially those built on myth, lies, and abuse. Before a state crumbles, it often appears strong, certain, and indomitable, projecting an image of a fortress destined to stand forever. Yet, if we pay attention, beneath the speeches, slogans, and myths, we can detect something else, a tremor, a fracture, a pressure building under the weight of its own contradictions. I invite you to explore this pressure with me, to understand the story of a state that asserts its permanence even as the ground begins to shift beneath it, a state that proclaims its unbreakability even as the cracks become visible to all, a state that believes history will make an exception for it, even though history never does. This is an analysis of the forces that shape nations and the forces that can break them. It is a study of how power can decay from within, how legitimacy can vanish, and how a project founded on fear, domination, and contradiction inevitably reaches a point where it can no longer sustain itself. Collapse doesn't occur in a single moment. It unfolds slowly, quietly, and invisibly until it doesn't. Today, we'll discuss that turning point, the signs, the fractures, and the narrative that few dare to tell, yet everyone senses. From the outside, Israel presents itself as an impenetrable fortress, a state wrapped in steel, surveillance, and the certainty of its own mythology, a nation that insists on its permanence, its power, its inevitability. A country that tells the world, again and again, that it cannot be shaken, cannot be questioned, cannot be touched. But power and permanence are not the same thing. And what looks solid from a distance can look very different when you step closer. So, okay,
Now I want to take you into a different story. Not the story told on cable news. Not the story repeated by politicians. A deeper story. One about fragility, pressure, and the cracks forming beneath the surface of a state that has spent decades convincing the world it has none.
Because states do not collapse in a single moment. They do not fall like trees struck by lightning. They erode. They strain. They fracture slowly, quietly, predictably. Until one day, the structure that looked eternal suddenly looks exhausted. This is not a prophecy. This is not a wish. This is an analysis, my analysis, of the forces that shape nations and the forces that break them. Every state carries within it the seeds of its own unraveling, the contradictions it refuses to confront, the injustices it normalizes, the violence it relies on to maintain control, the political fractures it pretends are unity, the moral debts it believes it will never have to pay. And Israel is no exception. Behind the image of strength lies a system under immense strain, political, social, demographic, economic, and moral. A system that has relied for decades on force, fear, and external support to maintain an internal order that is far more fragile than it appears.
Okay. So now we peel back the layers. We look at the pressures building inside the fortress. We examine the cracks forming in the walls. We explore the forces, internal and external, that challenge the narrative of permanence. Not because collapse is inevitable, not because collapse is imminent, but because understanding the fragility of power is essential to understanding the world we live in. This is the story behind the story. The one rarely told. The one many prefer to ignore. The one that reveals how nations rise and how they fall.
So now look at this and think about it. Every empire believes it will last forever. Every settler colony believes it is exceptional. Every nation built on domination believes history will make an exception for it. Israel is no different. It presents itself as a miracle, a fortress, a chosen project immune to the laws that govern every other state. But history is not sentimental. It does not care about myths. It cares about structures, and Israel's structures are failing. Not because of one war, not because of one leader, but because of the contradictions built into the very foundation of the state.
Are you with me so far? Look at this. Israel was built on a promise that has defined its identity since the moment it declared itself a state. A promise that it could be two things at once, even when those things pulled in opposite directions. It promised it could be both a democracy and a Jewish state. That it could be a homeland for one people while ruling over another. That it could be a refuge and a fortress, modern and colonial, liberal and militarized, all at the same time. It promised it could dominate millions of Palestinians indefinitely and still call itself free. That it could maintain permanent control over another population and still claim the moral vocabulary of equality, rights, and justice. These contradictions were not accidents. They were not temporary. They were not the result of one election, one leader, or one moment in history. They were built into the foundation. Into the laws, the borders, the policies, the ideology. They are structural, woven into the architecture of the state itself.
And structural contradictions always demand a price, because no nation can sustain two identities that cancel each other out. No state can be both democratic and exclusionary without tearing itself apart. No system can claim freedom while enforcing occupation without creating fractures that deepen over time. No government can rely on permanent military rule and still pretend it is governed by universal principles. These contradictions don't explode overnight. They don't announce themselves with a single event. They erode slowly, like pressure building beneath the surface of a mountain. They accumulate in politics, in society, in the economy, in the moral fabric of a nation. And eventually, they reach a point where the structure begins to strain under its own weight.
What we are witnessing today, the political chaos, the internal divisions, the international isolation, the moral crisis, is not random. It is not sudden. It is not surprising. It is the natural outcome of a system built on incompatible promises. A state cannot be both permanent and dependent on endless force. It cannot be both democratic and unequal. It cannot be both a homeland and a project of domination. It cannot be both modern and rooted in a colonial logic that the world has already rejected. These contradictions do not disappear. They accumulate, they harden, they crack. And when they crack, they reveal the truth beneath the surface, a truth that was always there, waiting to be seen.
So, okay, to gain insights into the future of Israel, it may be useful to consider the historical example of Rhodesia. Rhodesia was a settler colony that maintained a belief in its longevity, supported by military strength, backing from Western allies, and a prevailing narrative of destiny. Its settler population was convinced of its leadership role. Despite this, Rhodesia ultimately faced collapse, not through military defeat, but due to political, demographic, and moral challenges. Observers might draw parallels between the trajectories of Rhodesia and Israel.
So you see where I'm going? Rhodesia believed it could suppress the majority forever. Israel believes the same. Rhodesia believed the world would tolerate apartheid indefinitely. Israel believes the same. Rhodesia believed its military strength guaranteed its survival. Israel believes the same. But military power cannot solve political impossibilities. And Israel faces an impossibility. It cannot be both a Jewish majority state and a state ruling over millions of Palestinians who are not Jewish. This contradiction is not sustainable. It is combustible.
So that brings me to a question. What is Israel's greatest fear? Israel's greatest fear is not Iran, not Hezbollah, not Hamas. Its greatest fear is arithmetic. Between the river and the sea, Palestinians already outnumber Jews. The state knows this, the military knows this, the intelligence agencies know this. Every Israeli government has known this. And this is why Israel cannot stop expanding, why it cannot stop displacing, why it cannot stop controlling, why it cannot stop killing. Because the moment it stops, the demographic truth becomes political truth. A state cannot survive when its founding logic is incompatible with the population it rules.
Collapse does not always come from outside. Sometimes it begins quietly, internally, in the places a nation refuses to look, in the tensions it hides, in the contradictions it denies, in the fractures it pretends are unity. Inside Israel, those fractures are widening, not because of one event, not because of one leader, but because the internal pressures that have been building for decades are now pushing against each other all at once. There is the divide between secular Israelis who want a modern liberal state and religious communities who believe the state must be governed by religious law. There is the tension between settlers, driven by ideology and expansion, and the military establishment, which often sees those same settlers as destabilizing and unpredictable.
Okay, So look at this with me. There is the long-standing conflict between ultra-Orthodox communities who are exempt from military service and rely heavily on state subsidies and tax-paying Israelis who feel they are carrying the economic and military burden alone. There is the cultural and political divide between liberal Israelis who want integration into the global democratic order and far-right factions who believe compromise is weakness and domination is survival. And beneath all of this lies a deeper, older fracture, the divide between Ashkenazi elites who historically held political and economic power and Mizrahi communities who have long felt marginalized and excluded. These are not small disagreements. These are not policy debates.
these are identity conflicts, competing visions of what the state is, what it should be, and who it belongs to.
So, this is not a united society. It is a society held together by fear. Fear of Palestinians, fear of Arabs, fear of the world, and increasingly, fear of each other. Fear has become the glue. Fear has become the ideology. Fear has become the justification for everything, from military policy to political rhetoric to the expansion of state power. But a state built on fear cannot sustain itself. Fear is not a foundation. It is a fault line. And fault lines do not stay quiet forever. They shift. They widen. They crack under pressure. What we are witnessing today is not sudden. It is not unexpected. It is the natural outcome of a system that has relied on fear instead of cohesion, on domination instead of equality, on fragmentation instead of unity. Collapse, if it comes, and it will not come from the outside. It will come from within, from the unresolved contradictions that have been there since the beginning. This is not a prediction. This is not a wish. This is an analysis, my analysis, of the forces that shape nations and the forces that break them.
So, for decades, Israel relied on one thing, Western support. But the world is changing. Young Americans, even young conservatives, no longer see Israel as a moral project. Europe is fracturing. The global South is rising. The old alliances are weakening. The moral shield that protected Israel for 75 years is cracking. And Israel knows it. The world is no longer buying the narrative. Not after Gaza, not after the West Bank, not after the settlements, not after the massacres, not after the videos, the testimonies, the satellite images, the mass graves. Israel is losing the one thing it cannot survive without: legitimacy.
A state can't survive on ideology alone. It needs an economy. And Israel's economy is cracking under the weight of endless war, endless militarization, endless occupation. Tech companies are leaving. Investors are pulling out. Tourism is collapsing. The military budget is exploding. The workforce is shrinking. A state can't be both a high-tech hub and a permanent war machine. One will destroy the other.
By now, I guess you can read my mind. Every state has a story it tells itself. Israel's story was simple. We are the victims. We are the miracle. We are the light. But Gaza shattered that story. The world saw the bombs, the starvation, the mass graves, the children, the hospitals, the journalists, the executions, the destruction of an entire people. A state can't survive when its moral narrative collapses, when the world sees what it truly is, when the mask falls, and the mask has fallen.
Israel's collapse will not come in a single moment. It will come through pressure, fracture, exhaustion, and isolation. Through the slow unraveling of a project built on contradictions it can no longer hide. The question is not if, the question is how long can a state survive when its foundation is incompatible with reality? History has already answered that question. In Rhodesia, in South Africa, in Algeria, in every settler colony that believed it was eternal. Israel is not the exception. It is the next chapter in a story the world has seen before.
Okay. No. It's not what you think. This is not about revenge. This is not about hatred. This is not about wishing collapse on anyone. This is about understanding the forces that shape nations and the forces that break them. A state built on domination cannot last. A state built on fear cannot last. A state built on contradiction cannot last. And when Israel collapses, whether in 10 years or 50, it will not be because of rockets or armies. It will be because no state can survive forever while denying the humanity of the people it rules. History is not sentimental. It is inevitable.
I think we're done for today. I've said what I needed to say, and I hope, truly, that the message landed with clarity, with honesty, and with the weight it deserves. But before we close, I want to leave you with something. Jonathan Paz. If you haven't heard the name before, it's time to pay attention. People across Massachusetts have been buzzing about him. Jonathan Paz, congressman candidate, a name that's been echoing from community centers to coffee shops. And here's what people keep saying about him. He doesn't talk down to anyone. He doesn't stand above the crowd. He stands in it. Folks describe him as someone you can walk up to, shake hands with, and actually have a real conversation. Not a performance, not a photo op, a genuine exchange. And according to supporters, he listens, no matter your background, your faith, your income, your story. And there's one detail his supporters highlight again and again. They say he's running without backing from organizations that could influence his future positions. That means he never established any ties with AIPAC. Supporters call him independent, unaligned, and focused on the people who elected him. So if you're hearing his name everywhere, that's why. Supporters want to make sure it sticks. Jonathan Paz, remember it. Come and meet him in person at Cafe Yafanadic on May 17th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Talk to him, ask him questions, raise your concerns, or simply share a cup of tea. Come meet me too. I'll be there. Let's stand together for what's right. Let's stand together for what we believe in. Let's stand together with Jonathan Paz.
And just like that, we arrive at the final breaths of this week's broadcast. The soft dimming of a candle, the quiet settling of dust after a long, honest conversation. As you step back into your day, may you carry with you the questions that refuse to be buried, the courage that refuses to dim, and the curiosity that keeps truth alive in a world that so often tries to smother it. I'm Arlene Russell, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been an honor, an hour rooted in clarity, in dignity, in a solidarity that does not vanish when the headlines shift or when the cameras look away. If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or opened a door you didn't know was there, and if you ever feel the pull to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space will always have room for you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To you, our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, your willingness to walk this difficult path beside us. Your presence is the quiet proof that truth still matters, that memory still matters, that resistance still matters.
If you missed any part of today's program, you can find us on every major platform: YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radioforall.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine, or TWIP, and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care. Stay grounded. Stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is occupied land. This is Palestine. And the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine, from the river to the sea. فلسطين حرة.
شيل شيل عالجمالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل من الله ناسهر على نجوم الليل انا داويلو شيل شيل عالجمالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو ويل ويل عالظالمي